Mr. Harrison, reel three.
We got up in the morning, this eye-tie had gone, complete with a tachy case full of money. And Lloyd Owen says, well, we'll have to get him, because he's lived with the patrol for a week. He knows more about the patrol than, you know, than anyone really should know about the patrol. We'll have to get him. So we set up to track him. In particular, it's this little Arab boy. And Titch Cave. And we were getting nearer and nearer and nearer to Murada. And then we got him. He'd got in a little gully. And he'd covered himself with stones. Anyway, we yanked him out. Well, what can you do? You know, you don't want to guard him. You don't want to guard the damn fella. So, yes, somewhere on one of the trucks with a pair of handcuffs. See? So we got these handcuffs, and we handcuffed him to the tailboard of the lorry. The patrol having to return to Cairo, having to return to Siwa, because the whole thing was blown, obviously. And we put him on the tailboard of the lorry, principally, because it's the worst damn place to sit on a lorry. You've got a tremendous bashing if you sat on the back of a lorry, as you can imagine. And of course, when we stopped at night, you know, we suddenly realised we'd no damn keys for this for these handcuffs. So all we did, we just took the tailboard off the lorry and just dropped it in the desert with him. It was like an anchor. He couldn't move. And we kept him there, and he had it all the way back to Siwa. Every night we used to stop, take the tailboard off, just dump it, and he was anchored to it until we eventually got back to Siwa. And we still wouldn't take it. We still wouldn't let him take his handcuffs off until the intelligence officer flew out from Cairo to uplift this fella and take him back to Cairo. And that was the end of that. But there's a sequel to it. At a reunion 4 years ago, Lloyd Owen came up to me with a charming little fella. Said, you know this chap, Harry? No, I said, never seen him in my life before. And it turned out he was the Arab lad who'd gone on this job with this Italian and had helped to find him. And then he was something like, I don't know, military attaché to the Libyan government in London. And he'd looked up Lloyd Owen, and Lloyd Owen had invited him to come to the reunion. So it was quite exciting, really.
Did you know what the object of this Italian's mission was to be?
Just to gather information. There was a lot of this, I suppose, in any war. The more you know about the enemy, the better you are. And a lot of this was just to gather information, just to walk into the Tripoli or Benghazi or where have you, and get to know what was happening. It was all useful stuff.
Do you know why he defected?
He was just an Italian, I suppose. He'd got £1 million. And he was made for life, and he just wasn't as anti-Italian government as obviously the people in Cairo thought he was. It more or less, acting more or less like a double agent, I suppose. We thought he was on our side, and actually he was on the Italian side.
Did you ever get lost in the desert?
Never. Never. I knew very few people who did. With a most marvellous system of navigation. We used to drive on the Bagnell Sun Compass. We used to get up in the morning very early, and as soon as a shadow appeared on the Sun Compass, we used to set off, having been given the bearing to drive on. We used to stop at midday in the summertime, because with the sun being overhead, it didn't cast a shadow on the compass. And then as soon as ever it started, a shadow used to drive again until the sun went down. And that was your dead reckoning. You used to know within a few miles of where you were. And then every night they used to get the theodolite out and shoot the stars. And on a really good night, where you could shoot a fair number of stars, they could nearly tell, you could nearly tell to within yards where you were. Our navigation was absolutely wonderful.
Going back to the incident with the Italian, do you know what date it was? Have you any idea?
No. Oh dear. You know. I have a good memory for stories, but I can't always remember them in sequence. I can't remember the year.
Was it towards the beginning or towards the end of your time with the in the desert?
It would be about in the middle of the time in the desert, middle of the time in the desert.
Would that be, about 42?
Yes, about, no, 43 probably. We went up and down the desert a lot of times, you know. You know, you get a bit confused.
You were telling me about an incident later where a group got into difficulties because their officer went into an Arab village.
Yeah,
could you repeat that?
Captain Sims and his driver, who was Harry Chard, who was, before the war, tram car driver in Liverpool. And they walked into this village to have a look around and never came out.
Where was that?
I forget the name of the village, but it was well up the desert. It was one of these little Arab oases, and it was garrisoned, I suppose, by Italian troops. And Captain Sims thought he'd get away with it, and he didn't. I suppose it was a bit of a silly thing to do, really, but again, I suppose, looking for information. This seemed to be the principal role of LRDG, getting information. And he didn't come back, and the patrol was a bit of a quandary. They didn't know what the heck to do. And I know we just got back from a patrol, and we suddenly got a call out, and we went out and met the patrol and brought them back.
What state were they?
Through Jerobum. Oh, they were, you know, they were upset at losing their officer, but this time they were getting short of water in particular, because I think they'd hung around for quite a long time looking for him, waiting for him. They were getting a bit short of water, and it's a bit panicky when you're in a situation where you're getting short of water, and you're a long way from home, and you've lost the officer and one thing and another. A bit of a panicky situation. But we went out, we met them, and Lloyd Owen took charge of the patrol, and we just came back via Jarabum back into Siwa again.
How many of them did you collect?
Well, there were 15 in a patrol. They'd lost about 13 of them. But they hadn't lost a lorry, you see. They still had the lorry. Because they walked into the village.
So this was up near the coast, was it?
No, inland. It was in the Western Desert, but the southern end of the Western Desert. Very silly, really. I should know the name of the village, but I don't. My memory's not as good as that.
Do you know when approximately that would have been?
That'd be 42, I would think. That'd be 42. Yes.
Now, you were talking to me off the record earlier about the raid on Tobruk.
Oh, yes, yes.
Can you tell me about that in as much detail as you can recollect?
Yes, well, again, I think this was the brainchild of Hazeldine. This is when the fighting was going on, when the Germans broke through and were eventually stopped just short of Alex. And they had the idea that if they could capture Tobruk and hold Tobruk for, say, 24 hours and destroy all the supplies in there, it would so disrupt the German military machine, it would have to withdraw. And so this plan was devised, and we were back in Cairo on leave. Well, I think everyone in Cairo knew about this. Everybody. Baham and everybody knew about it. Anyway, we set off and we drove down the Nile and we went to Kufra. And when we got to Kufra, We took 200 tanks with us. Why the hell are we going to take tanks? I don't know.
To what tanks?
Honey tanks. They were little reconnaissance tanks. And halfway over the a big sand sheet, aircraft can land anywhere within a 500-mile radius. These two tanks bumped into each other and took the tracks off. And of course, the drivers got out and we took them back to down to Kufra with us, and they were flown back. And as far as I know, the tanks are still there. But anyway, we got down to Kufra, and the idea was the commandos were going in, and they were all German commandos, German Jews, and they were nearly all dressed in British uniforms, obviously, but some of them were dressed in German uniforms, and they were the guard. And the idea was to get to the to Tobruk, and the guards, they said, we're taking these chaps to the prisoner of war camp, you see. Sorry we're a bit late, it's getting dusk, one thing another. And the German sentries on the outskirts of Tobruk would let them through. And once they got through, they were then to make to the coast. They were to silence the coastal batteries and the destroyers were to come in, I think two in particular, the Sikh and the Zulu, along with a load of commandos, and we were taken over to Brook. My particular patrol, we had to accompany these commandos, we had to lead them to the outskirts of Tobruk, we had to leave them to complete the last few miles on their own to go into Tobruk, and then, soon after it got dusk, we were to move into Tobruk. We were to go to the POW camp, release all the prisoners of war, and tell them to get down to the beach where the landing craft would be, Sikh, Zulu, plus landing craft to take them off. Then we were to go to the aerodrome and destroy as many aircraft as we could on the aerodrome. And then when the operation was over, come home. And everything went reasonably well, except we got a little bit behind target because these commando boys, they were in three tonners, which A, weren't as good as our 1300 weights, and B, they didn't have the experience of driving in the desert like we did. So Lloyd Owen moved three or four of us over to drive these three tonners to try to put a bit of speed and catch time up. Anyway, we got to Tobruk. We got to Tobruk on time, on the outskirts of Tobruk. And we left the commandos there to go in on their own, which they did. And I think the Navy were IC operations for this, because the messages we were getting through all started off, hush, most secret, and then you would get the message. And we'd just seen these commandos drive away, and we suddenly saw a motorbike appear and chase after these three tonners and then stop and turn around and go back. And Lloyd Owen said, we must get that motorbike. So we tore after this motorbike, and it vanished over the little wadi, and when we got to the top, we'd got a 1500 weight truck. And it was a load of Itais. They were out looking for wood, for firewood, I think it was scrounged. And they got a 1500 weight. And it was stuck in the sand and they couldn't get it out. And they'd seen these three tonners go past and thought, get one of these three tonners to come and give us a tow. Anyway, the motorbike couldn't catch them up. So in point of fact, they were quite innocent. If we'd have known that, we'd have completely known it, but we didn't know that. And so we were stuck there with all these blooming Italian prisoners. So, anyway, we left them and we drove to the outskirts of Tobruk, where we had to just wait for further instructions. And we waited and waited and waited. And people kept driving out of Tobruk because the bombers came over, and I think it was the first time they dropped a 5,000 or a 10,000 pound bomb or something biggest bomb ever been dropped on the Middle East, all to cause a diversion. And so these German thought, I'm not damn well, I'll go out in the desert and have a decent night's kip. And of course we were waiting at the barrier, and so we shot a few of those as they came out, and we waited and waited, and we just got no message at all. The whole thing, as it turned out, was a fiasco. The commandos never destroyed the coastal batteries, because I believe they were waiting for them. The Sikh and the Zulu came in and were sunk. And the whole thing was a bit of a shambles, really. I think the lack of security was the main reason. There was no security at all. Because the plan was a damn good plan, really. And so we just waited, and it was dawn, and we drove out of Tobruk. And I remember we drove through a huge army camp, German army camp, and the cooks were just getting up, getting the fires lit, ready for the breakfast, and odd fellas walking about, going to the latrines and having a wash and things like that, and we just drove through and waved to them all and kept on going and drove into the desert.
What was their reaction?
We're back. Why not? Five trucks driving through your camp, sort of early morning, waving to you. Why not wave back? You know? Can't possibly be enemy, can it? All that way behind the German lines, impossible. And it'd been, and some of the other patrols had been raiding Benghazi and various other places, and it was quite a shoot up that night. Quite a lot of fellows were wounded, and we met up with some of them, with Doc Lawson, and they sent an aircraft up from Kufra to a landing ground, which a piece of desert that was useful as a landing ground. And this aircraft came up, and it was the oldest damned aeroplane I've ever seen in my life, flown by a South African, literally had an outside toilet, you know, and the whole of the inside of the aeroplane was full of petrol cans, and we had to form a chain and take all this petrol out of the inside of the aircraft and fill the tanks that were on the wings. And then he set off and took the wounded with Doc Lawson back to Kufra. And that was the end of the episode, really. It was a bit of a disaster, really, from word go. We lost quite a lot of very, very nice chaps. I know one, I made very great friends of one young commando, Shiletto. His father was chief constable of Glasgow, and he was a grandfella, and he used to insist on wearing the kilt, and we used to have some great fun teasing him about what the Scots were wearing and all this, you know, the usual things. And I don't know why, but I wish many times I'd call and see his father and mother after the war in Glasgow, although I don't know what you can tell them. But he was a wonderful lad, and he was killed on the raid, as they were nearly all killed on the raid, including Hesseldine. They lost them nearly all.
Yes. Before we leave the desert, are there any other incidents that you can recollect, that we can record?
It was just after the big tank battle, I think it was at Sidi Rezegh, where we lost 500 tanks, I think it was, in a day. I think General Ritchie was given his bowler hat over that. Well, we happened to be passing through the area, Y Patrol, the next day. And we were among all these tanks. And all over the place there were German and Italian, I suppose, with these low loaders, dragging these tanks, ours and theirs, onto these low loaders and whipping them back. And as far as we could see, not many of our tanks were damaged. They'd probably run out of petrol. But I felt very, very sorry for the tank crews, because the biggest gun we had was a 6-pounder. Most of them had a 2-pounder on. And the German Tiger tanks had 88 millimetre. You know, I mean, you didn't stand a chance. But that was quite hairy that day. There were all these Germans driving about, and we were just driving through them, you know. Sort of, how do you do, and one thing another. And another incident that springs to mind, we were on a road watch, and we were up at, way up beyond Marble Arch, right in the desert. And the Germans launched an attack, and they broke through, and they got into Egypt, and they eventually stopped at El Alamein. Well, we were way up the desert. And if they hadn't have held them at El Alamein, if they'd have got through to the canal zone, and they'd have taken Alexandria and Cairo, etc., etc., we were really up the creek without the paddle. And I think that was the first and only time I remember going on half rations for water and food, because it looked as though we were going to have to probably go to Rhodesia, right through Chad and all the way down, which is a hell of a long way. And I suppose once we'd have got round the Chad area, we would have been all right for petrol, food and water, but we didn't know this. And the line held at El Alamein, which, as you know, is a sea at one side, and the Qatar Depression at the other side. And so we drove back, and then eventually we went through the Qatar Depression. And as far as I know, we were the first and probably the only patrol ever to go through the Qatar Depression. And by God, depression is the right word for it. Just 1,000 feet deep, and at the bottom just a salt marsh, and your trucks were sinking in right up to the body. The only way you could get a truck out was to unload it and tie 3-4 trucks onto it and drag it out and then try another route. It was a terrible, terrible journey, but we got through and we finished up back behind our own lines, and we was living in the shade of the pyramids. We had quite a nice time there, and then next patrol we went down to Kufra again and round there.
Was there any time when you nearly lost your life in the desert?
I think when you got attacked by aircraft, this is what as near as you can say. We very, very seldom had a sort of a face-to-face confrontation, you know, bayonets fixed and teeth bared sort of thing. We weren't looking for that type of confrontation. We would far, far sooner get in and get the information and get out without them knowing we'd been there. Unless, I say, as a road watch had finished and we got instructions to do some damage to the road. So, but I think aircraft were a worse period. I mean, there's not a member of the LRDG that hasn't sometime or other hidden very effectively behind a twig of camel thorn, you know. And somehow, if you turn your back on the aircraft and lay behind a twig of camel thorn, you think you're perfectly safe. I suppose those were the most dangerous times. But we're never in any fear of losing a life through being lost or lack of water or anything like that. The organisation was far, far too good for that. There was no risk of that whatsoever. It wasn't to just drive up there and see what happens sort of a job.
Can you describe to me on tape the wounding of General Lloyd Irwin?
Mm. We'd just come back from this raid. And
is this a Tobruk raid?
The Tobruk raid. And I think for the first time ever, it was in the paper about pirates of the desert or some damn silly thing, etc., etc. And we were down at Kufra, and I'd just taken two wagons up and loaded up with petrol, with cans of petrol, filled all the jerry cans, and taken them back to the oasis, our own particular part of the oasis, for the lads to fill the lorries up and get ready for the next patrol. And suddenly we heard these aircraft engines and also all the smoke coming up from the depot and that, where we used to keep all our stuff. And these blasted German aircraft come down. And I forget what they sort of fighter bombers, Heinkels, I think, or something like that. And of course they were coming low, bombing this little village, and then keeping low over this big salt sheet, and just starting to climb away when they got over the oasis, where we were. And all the other patrols were all scattered various parts of the oasis. So we got the vehicles in fairly open positions, you know, so we could get a range of fire. And as these aircraft were coming towards us, they were an absolute perfect target. I mean, great big fat bellies towards you, and climbing away. And of course, they didn't fly very fast then, not like they do today. And a really perfect target. And we were pouring rubbish into them. You know, we'd got twin Brownings, we'd 0.5 Brownings, with tremendous firepower. And we came to the conclusion that these must have been extra special aircraft, because it didn't seem to have any been having an effect on them. And anyway, suddenly Lloyd Owen let out a cry and looked round, and it was laid down there, and I thought he'd lost his arm. I thought he'd blown his arm off. I think he was hit by a cannon shell or something like that. And, of course, you know, that knocked a lot of the steam out. Anyway, by this time, the action was nearly over, and the aircraft left a few minutes later. And we put Lloyd Owen onto a stretcher. And it was quite a long way up to the airfield and up, you know, to the, where we kept the officers. And we couldn't put him on a truck. It was far, far too bumpy. And we carried him. We took it in relays of carrying him. And we carried him to a little medical tent there they had. And the docs took over. Then they flew a plane from Cairo to... flew him back to Cairo. And none of us ever thought we'd see him again, you know. We thought, A, he'd be lucky to live. And B, if he did live, he'd lose his arm or something like that. And damn me, within no time at all, he was back. And he was in charge of the patrol. And so thundering determined. We used to be driving along, and he'd say, let me have a drive, Harry. I said, no. You do your job and I'll do my job. I drive. You're the officer in charge. And a bit of leg pull thing. And we all knew why he wanted to drive. It was sheer determination to use his arm. And he used to get hold of the steering wheel with this gammy arm and didn't let go. And as the wheel turned, so his arm used to turn with it. And so it's a forced exercise of the arm. And, of course, he eventually got, he never got the full use of it back, not like you or I are, but, I mean, it was